Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I'm excited to be back here with you in our next episode here in 2017. And it's wintertime here in the Northern Hemisphere, for those of you that are listening in that end of the world. And so we're going to be talking about some winter-related topics. Of course, can't talk about that without getting into discussing things with our co-host and one of our ski patrol experts on the show today, Sam Bradley.
Why, thank you, Jamie. It's been a while, but I get to put that hat back on. And it was something I very much love to do. And it's something we really haven't talked about is ski resorts, which a lot of people do, ski safety issues, what happens when the lift goes down. And our guy Kyle, our weather dude, this guy has more hats than I would know what to do with. And that's one of his hats. Besides being a meteorologist, he very well knows about this and is going to give us a rundown on some specific incidents and some really good safety stuff. We also have Dr. Joe Holly with us. Hi, Joe.
Hey, guys. How are you?
And he will be talking a bit about some of the medical complications of having people stuck on a chairlift and whatever else. So we have some really good stuff we're going to talk about. So, Kyle, why don't you give us a little weather update and tell us what's going on? I know Joe and I were just talking before we started recording here that he had the weird thing in Memphis like we did here in Colorado where we had this below zero weather. It was like 19 in Memphis, which is pretty unheard of. And then, boom, like the next day, it's 50 degrees and melted. I mean, literally, I was watching it all. By the end of the day, there was no snow left. It was just completely weird. I don't know how common that is, but anyway, so that's kind of what's been going on. What are we looking for in the near future here?
Well, Sam, in the near future, we're looking for a little bit more of the same. Still an active weather pattern across the U.S., but in recent weather history, I guess we could say, California is in the news for several reasons, not only for the heavy rains and causing mudslides and landslides in the mountains and in the valleys there due to the really potent southwest flow coming off the Pacific, dumping a lot of moisture there in the mountains. I was just actually looking here tonight, and Mammoth Mountain in California has received now over 12 feet of snow in the last week or so. And that's absolutely incredible to look at some of the pictures coming out of there. Some of that moisture, a good chunk of it is making its way into Colorado as well, which is impacting our weather, both for travel on the urban side of things, for vehicle travel, as well as on the backcountry travel side of things. So folks that ski, snowboard, and snow machine in the backcountry. So we've seen with this storm lots of heavier, wetter snow than we're typically used to here in Colorado. And with how fast it accumulated, we had actually a bunch of natural avalanches run in the last 48 hours here, one of which ran this morning, January 10 here on I-70, just on the west side, I believe, of Vail Pass, which impacted three semis. Thankfully, no one was injured or killed, but that's and several other mountain passes closed across Colorado. And thankfully, as I was predicting in last week's episode, Atlanta did not get the worst of the winter weather precipitation that they could have. Thankfully, it was a more of a glancing blow for them. So active winter weather across the U.S.
Wow, you're reminding me of the fact that our friend Chris, who's up in Aspen, had put something up on Facebook that he was trying to get from there to Denver, and virtually every road was closed down with something. This was like in the middle of it. So, yeah, I can appreciate what you're saying. That's scary stuff. I mean, we've never even talked about avalanches, but that's a whole separate subject. But I guess, you know, 12 feet in Mammoth? My friend up there is probably in hog heaven, I think, I hope. But anyway, so you were going to tell us about, an incident that occurred last year. And as well, there's been seven, if I count them right, ski lift related incidents this year. So we can move into that after you tell us about this first thing. I'm anxious to hear this.
Sure. So for those of you that don't know, I am a ski patroller out here in Colorado. And one of my duties on patrol is serving as our lift evacuation coordinator. So at our resort, we only have chairlifts, but some of our neighboring resorts have some gondolas as well, that we are, of course, also concerned about. So the incident that Sam is referring to is occurred back in last December, December of 2015, and where we actually had a real evacuation of a chairlift at our resort. And thankfully, that was conducted without incident. No one was injured during that operation, the rescuers or the guests on the chairlift. And we safely evacuated all 80 passengers in a very, very safe and expedient fashion. And to conduct any kind of lift evacuation, of course, requires, or any operation requires, good planning. And that was really the key and why we were able to conduct this operation, you know, thankfully, with great success. So part of our plan, the key part really is that, you know, a lot of people look as ski patrol as kind of the be-all, end-all with anything that happens on mountains disaster-wise or within the resorts. But with any large-scale operation, especially a lift evac, no one ski patrol or mountain department can handle it. So we had good assistance from all our other mountain departments, including, you know, lift operations, lift maintenance, mountain management. And also we even had ski school instructors up there helping us out as well. So with any evacuation, the first thing that we do if a chairlift is down for an extended period of time, we have a time threshold and we'll send a line skier. And they'll go down, they'll reassure the guests, tell them that maintenance is working on the problem, and they'll also have a guide sheet with them where they can note the number of guests on each chair and where those chairs are on the lift from top to bottom. And that gives our operations person on patrol a good picture, a quick picture of what patrons may need to be evacuated first. For example, if there's young children on the chairlift, perhaps they're more, you know, they're more prone to exposure in the cold. If it, those are the conditions for that day, perhaps depending on what caused the chairlift to stop, people could be injured. Or also we have an increasing number of adaptive athletes with access and other functional needs that are getting out into the snow sports world, which is awesome. But that presents a unique challenge for us when we're having to perhaps evacuate a chairlift. So we're making special note of that as well. And we, of course, put out the page for assistance. We get our equipment ready, get that staged. And then when we received the go order to evacuate, we start with addressing our critical patients or our critical guests first, those that have to come down, and we assign either, you know, one or both methods of lift evacuation. So the two that we have that we use are both ground and aerial based. So essentially, we deploy on some of our taller spans, so the distance between the chair and the ground or the snow surface. We can deploy what we call cable riders. And those are folks that use machines that are designed to ride on the cable with the rescuer attached to that machine. And so we conduct the evacuation of that span or spans with that rescuer in the air. And conversely, our ground-based evacuation for spans that are a little bit lower to the ground, we have our rescuers are on the ground and we rig up a rope over the chair and over the chairlift cable. And that allows us to then conduct that evacuation with the patroller or rescuer based on the ground. And so a combination of those methods safely gets those people down. And it's a heck of a story to tell. And we were, again, very fortunate that no rescuers or guests were injured or adversely affected during that chairlift evacuation.
Wow. I mean, I know all of us have questions, and I've got a bunch myself, but I wanted to throw something to Joe because you're touching on something really important, that the reason this was successful was because you not only trained within the patrol, but everybody at the hill, and I remember doing it that way as well, that from operations to ski instructors that may have a part in this, they all need to train together. And of course, Joe, that's what you guys do at Paragon. So I'm sure that's what you're thinking, that, you know, that's why this training is so important. Would you agree?
Oh, I would completely agree. It's what makes those things work smoothly because everybody knows what to do and knows what to expect. Kyle, I'm curious, when you're getting people off of the place, the chairs, basically, where do you put folks? Do they go into a vehicle and then they're moved to a shelter of some sort, or do you kind of set up triage out there in the snow and sort them out there?
Well, that's a great question. And with this evacuation that we conducted, one of the challenges for us is that this chairlift served terrain that traverses some of the runs that are perhaps more advanced than the skiers riding that lift would be able to ski in, as well as some unconsolidated snow areas. And so we, you know, kind of have to assess that, you know, chair by chair, guest by guest. And we were using, we had our snowmakers out there. Our snowmaking crew brought some of their people up on snow machines, and we were able to deploy them down to assist in taking people to the bottom of the hill, and where we were able to then, you know, get their information and make sure that they were, you know, there's compensation that's provided based on our plan. Also, there were some people, one that I responded to that was evacuated, and her legs had gotten and feet had gotten pretty cold, and this person was not able to continue down the mountain on the snowboard, so I had to bring a toboggan and give this person a ride down to the bottom in a toboggan. They weren't injured, but they were just not comfortable and not able to finish skiing or snowboarding down that run. And I've heard of other mountains that this happens at bring out their snowcat fleet. If they have the snowcats that can have the big cabins on the back, and we can load people up in there, bring them down that way. But of course, some folks are just pretty stoked to get down off the chair and continue riding on down the mountain under their own power. So it varies.
I'm curious, Kyle, when you started this operation, you think you said 80 people. What's the time frame once you begin operations to evacuate? What kind of time frame are we talking about here to get 80 people off of chairlifts?
So for this particular operation, the evacuation of 80 folks spread out between the top and the bottom of the lift took, I believe, just under 3.5 hours, if I remember correctly. And you know, some people say, well, that's heck of a long time to sit up on the lift to be evacuated. And you know, ideally, in a perfect world, with all, if we had, you know, every, you know, all the assets at our disposal and everything was staged and ready, including our patrol colleagues from our neighboring mountains who came to assist us, our target is 2 hours. But with conditions, you know, depending on the workload at the other mountains or the other departments, some of that help may be delayed getting in. And we were able, though, to evacuate the line top to bottom in 3.5 hours.
Impressive. I mean, it seems like a long time, but we're talking about getting 80 people in a high angle rescue situation. So I can imagine, you know, it can take, you know, getting one person down out of a high space can take a couple of hours. So getting 80 people down is pretty impressive.
Absolutely. And of course, well, we do want to be, you know, expedient in getting folks down from the lift onto the snow. We also want to be able to do that safely, not just for the guests, but for our rescuers as well. So just being, you know, very methodical and, you know, relying on the training that were provided and trained on and drilled on every season is really the key. So yeah, it may take a little bit longer than people would like. I do recall there was one person who was very, very adamant about needing to get down to be able to honor a lunch appointment. But unfortunately, you know, that wasn't able to get her down in time for her lunch appointment. However, still, we were able to get her down safely without injury, and that's really the key here.
Absolutely. Well, I was kind of curious, too, about a couple things. What were the weather conditions that day, because I remember whenever we had a problem at the hill I worked in Southern California, it was always seemed to be in the worst weather conditions. And that, of course, would impact your other folks getting up there, people coming from other hills and all of that, not to mention, which we'll talk about later, the hypothermia and different issues that the people would deal with. And then the second part of that question is, and I have practiced the lift evac and done it any number of times, but like Jamie was saying, especially on the high angle situations, what do you do when you get somebody up there that's just too petrified to come down?
Well, once again, you know, weather rears its head for another operation. And we are particularly susceptible to weather. And Sam, as you indicated, many chairlift incidents or gondola incidents, they don't happen during fair weather. However, in this case, this was an electrical issue that caused the chairlift to stop working. And we were extremely fortunate that we actually had pretty calm weather and partly cloudy skies, if I recall correctly. And we actually were, again, very fortunate, because about 45 minutes after we skied the line and verified that there was no guests or equipment left on the line, a massive storm front rolled in and dropped the visibilities to zero. The winds picked up. And so we were very, very happy that we were able to conduct that evacuation before that got in there. And, of course, with the second part, of your question there, remind me what that was again.
Well, when you get people, especially in a high angle situation, who have never been evacuated, and this is really scary stuff for them, whether it's little kids or older people, that are they're just too afraid to go down. What do you do to help coax them down?
Ah, yes. So it's actually not that uncommon to have folks that that are riding chairlifts that, if you did have to get evacuated, or even if the chair stops, perhaps, there's a bit of that fear factor, and I completely understand that. One of the ways that we have is if that is a span that's identified by our line skier, and there's someone that tells us, hey, I'm really freaking out, I'm really not comfortable with this, we are able to send a cable rider on that span. And so there's someone who can be there just above them, hanging on that haul line, and can talk them through it. In very extreme cases, we would actually rig up a rope and ascend up into the chair to get next to that person to assist them if they were just so scared that they just could not move and they were kind of paralyzed with fear, as it were. So those situations, of course, are very rare. We were I'm not aware of any that occurred during our chairlift evacuation, but that is something that we train and practice for during our ongoing training throughout the season.
That would make perfect sense, because I'm sure you're going to get some of that. We don't want these people walking away with PTSD after this incident. But it sounds like you guys did a great job, and that your training really worked, and that's what got to make you feel good.
Absolutely. And as with any incident that occurs, there's always some great lessons learned that come out of it. And so between the season that occurred and this season, there's been several updates, feedback from all the players and rescuers that were involved in that operation. And we are now better prepared should that happen again. And we are very fortunate where with our neighboring mountains, we share a lot of information and tactics and things. And so we were all able to kind of put our heads together, address some issues that were identified, as well as incorporate lessons learned into future planning and training.
No better training than the real thing. So tell us, Kyle, what's some of the stuff that's gone on this year already? I'm sure we'll have to have several updates because it's just the beginning of winter, basically. But what's been going on?
Well, in the chairlift-related incident world, we're unfortunately off to a pretty interesting start, I guess I would term it, to 2017, or I guess I should say the 2016-2017 ski season. We've had an unfortunate incident that occurred back in December of 2016 up at Granby, Colorado. There's a ski resort up there where a mother and her two children were, they fell from the chairlift, and the mother unfortunately died as a result of her injuries. Children, fortunately, survived, and that is still under investigation by the Colorado, the Passenger Tramway Safety Board. There was also a few other incidents, one up in at Mount Ashland in Oregon, as well as one in Arapahoe Basin, Colorado, and two out in Utah. And all those seem to revolve around, you know, whatever the cause may be, why the people fell from the chair. What it revolves around is that they were hung up either by a backpack strap in most cases, or in one case, there was actually someone who was dangling upside down from a strap of their snowboard. And so later on in the episode, we'll talk a little bit about some safety tips and some best practices for riding chairlifts here when you're out on the slopes.
That's a lot of things to consider, especially when you think about, you know, how much has happened already this year. And that they all seem to be related to a similar problem. And it seems unusual that this hasn't cropped up in the past.
Truly, yes. And, you know, whether we have not been paying attention to it, whether it hasn't been making the news, or whether it just hasn't been being recorded or reported, there's any number of factors that go into it. But this year has really piqued my interest, not only with my role as lift evacuation coordinator, but also as, you know, just someone who enjoys, you know, skiing and riding at resorts across the country, and who has several friends that does that as well. And, you know, if we can, we're actually here now in January in the midst of Skier Safety Month. And so I thought, you know, what better time to address some of these issues that have come up so far this season, and how we can prevent them going forward in the future.
Yeah, I find I can talk better when I unmute myself. So thanks for jumping in there, Jamie. I'm wondering why I was talking to myself. We do that once in a while. But you had a number of subtopics that you wanted to talk about, Kyle, and I think they're all really good ones, because lift evac is just one of the many things, because people don't associate ski resorts with disaster. If they do, it's probably the avalanche, because that's what you always see on the Weather Channel. But besides chairlift, I mean, I worked a lot of medical. I, in fact, run the patrol room most of the time, so I would take everybody coming in off the mountain and go to the next level of whatever they did on the hill, and then decide if they needed to go to the hospital and those kinds of things. So there's a lot of medical on the hill and at the base resort. Then there, of course, is avalanches and chairlift issues. But you also mentioned fires. I really wasn't ready for that one. So tell us a little bit about those kinds of things.
Well, Sam, as you indicated, ski patrol is really a versatile role. You know, we're not just the ski cops that are out there to get you because you may be skiing too fast or perhaps a little bit recklessly in our slow zones. And we also don't just do the medical side of it. Most resorts, a lot of the equipment that you see on the hill, any, you know, ropes, bamboo, flagging, banners, other closures, ski patrol is responsible for that. And, of course, we touched on the medical side. We touched on the lift evacuation side. Avalanche, of course, avalanche rescue in some of the larger mountainous areas, both in the east and western mountainous areas. Avalanches are a big threat and big concern, not just within the resort sometimes, but also adjacent to the resort, because there can be some pretty inviting terrain that is accessed just outside the resort boundaries. And as the patrollers on the mountain, we are essentially the first responders who are most likely to be able to save someone caught in an avalanche if it's just outside of our resort boundaries. Of course, fires is one that I did mention in my little note to you guys here. And, you know, just if you're thinking about it, above the base area, there's really no way for the fire department in the wintertime to access those structures if a fire should break out. And so if it's above the base area, some of those, but not necessarily all buildings, will be sprinklered if they have those systems in place. And, you know, whatever, you know, sprinkler system, you know, whether it's a wet or a dry system. But if you think about it, if something breaks out on the hill, you know, ski patrol, we're us as well as the staff of that that building, whether it's a restaurant, a, you know, hotel, whatever it may be above the base area that's not accessible by vehicle or by ground transportation. You know, we would go in, we would help assist if the fire is, you know, manageable, to help try and get it under control and suppress it with, you know, handheld extinguishers. But of course, our primary goal would be assisting the staff in getting all the guests and the remaining staff out of that structure. And then, of course, we would jump back into our medical role. So triaging and assessing any injuries that may have resulted, and then transporting those that are injured by any methods that we can deploy to get them down to a higher level of care. And that's how, you know, one of the things that we do with fires. And so that's something that we train on routinely, you know, throughout the season and also preseason as well. And finally, you know, we talked about, you know, again, the medical, the chairlift and the avalanche side. But, you know, if you think about it, you know, there's a lot that goes into helping a resort to run and helping it to stay safe, even if it's not apparent or front facing. There's a lot that goes on planning and training behind the scenes so that if something does go wrong, we are prepared to respond, not just as a patrol, but as a whole mountain.
Yeah, and that's a point I want to add on to, because skiers have no idea how much work it takes to get that resort. The patrollers are up there at the crack of dawn. They're getting fences set up. They're looking for hazards. There's just a thousand tasks that are manual that they're up there doing just to make sure the mountain is safe for people to ski on. And then at the end of the day, we have to be the last ones down the hill to make sure all the guests are down off the hill. And I don't know about you, but with great regularity, when we're getting ready to go home, which is well after dark, somebody would come in and say, oh, I'm missing so-and-so. So we'd end up having to do a search all through the resort. Sometimes we'd find them in the bar or the bathroom. Sometimes they will have left the resort and didn't tell anybody, but we're there for hours and hours and hours. And in some cases, we're out there at night doing a search and rescue operation, which always seems to be in the worst of weather conditions. So, you know, for you skiers, say thank you to those patrollers. And I didn't even touch on all the training that they have to do pretty much year long. So it's a pretty big deal to keep those resorts moving. Jamie or Joe, you have any thoughts or questions on any of this?
Well, this is Joe. I was just thinking about the challenges of moving people in situations like that. I mean, even 5 or 10 people that are in the incredibly austere environment of a ski slope, or especially those that are more adventurous and are tending to ski in non-designated areas. The amount of resources to locate those people, treat those people, and then move them out of that scenario and do so with some level of safety to the rescuers is amazing. I think from a disaster medicine standpoint, this is a real easy situation to appreciate that it doesn't take large numbers of people to really put you kind of into the disaster mindset very quickly.
I absolutely agree. And that is one of the points I wanted to bring up is, you know, comparing, you know, the non-urban or semi-urban side, I guess you could say, of ski patrol, where we're not really backcountry, but we're not really urban. We're kind of in that side country type interface where, you know, for us, what defines, like, say, an MCI or a multiple casualty incident for us or a true disaster, it's very different from what it might be in an urban setting. So if you consider in an urban setting where you may have, you know, multiple, you know, resources, perhaps, you know, easy pathways to get there, and perhaps there are facilities and plans in place to accommodate multiple, say, critical patients, where, say, for us, depending on how many, you know, patrollers are on staff that day, as well as, you know, what else is going on in the mountain, if there's special events or other things or other calls for service we're responding to, we could have one or possibly even two critical patients, and that's an MCI for us, and that's essentially a little mini disaster that we have, because that could empty out our people power, our resources, as well as some of our equipment as well, to manage those patients and ensure that they have the best possible care and rapid transport to the next level of care. So it really introduces a kind of a unique challenge in the planning and the preparation, and why, you know, you can't just bring any paramedic in off of out of the back of an ambulance or off the street and put them on a slope side on snow and freezing weather and expect them to be able to manage a patient at the same level as they would in the back of an ambulance. So it's a whole new level of experience and training that really can result in some of our paramedics, who I think are absolutely some of the best in the world at what they do, and being able to improvise and adapt to the conditions and perform exceptionally well.
And we're going to wrap up this episode at the end of this partial segment and pick up with part two of this episode next week. I want to thank our guest, Kyle Nelson, our local meteorologist for our disaster podcast, and we appreciate him coming on and talking about specific ski patrol-related disaster preparedness and training. I also want to thank Joe Holly from Paragon Medical Education Group. If you haven't had a chance to do so, please go over and check out their website at paragonmedicalgroup.com and let them know that you appreciate them supporting the disaster podcast. That's it for me and Sam Bradley. Again, check out part two of this episode, which will pick up where it left off next week. And you can pick it up there on Thursday at disasterpodcast.com. And we'll also be putting it up on our Facebook page. Just search for Disaster Podcast on Facebook and you'll find it there. That's it for me. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, wishing all of you safe travels. And as Sam always says, disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.